Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. What if you decided to pursue a career in medicine? You're fortunate enough to get accepted to medical school and 4 years later begin a residency. Then, a couple of years into that process, you start to have serious doubts about whether you're actually suited to the physician's lifestyle. What if one of your parents was a doctor? Even more, a doctor who had immigrated to the U.S. to give you a better life. And you felt tremendous pressure and kindredness that made a decision to possibly leave the field all the more anguishing. Such is the plight of my guest today, physician and author Dr. Sunita Puri. In her new memoir, That Good Night, Life and Medicine in the 11th Hour, Puri takes us through the lives of her parents, who were immigrants from India, who relocated to the U.S., and her own journey to become a doctor. Puri is the medical director of the Palliative Medicine and Supportive Care Service at the Keck Hospital and Norris Cancer Center at the University of Southern California, where she also serves as chair of the Ethics Committee. She graduated from Yale in anthropology and then studied modern history at Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar. She completed medical school and residency training at the University of California, San Francisco, and finally did a fellowship in hospice and palliative medicine at Stanford University. Puri writes beautifully about the emotions and heartbreak of caring for patients in great suffering, often but not always near the end of life. That Good Night, her memoir, offers poetic insight into what it's like to become a doctor whose most formidable tool is language. Sunita Puri, palliative care doctor and author of That Good Night, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Sunita Puri, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start by having you just remind us, what is palliative care?
Palliative care is a specialized type of medical care that attends to the physical, emotional, and spiritual suffering that patients and their families experience when living with a serious illness.
How does it differ from hospice or end-of-life care specifically?
Great question. So palliative care is available really at any stage of someone's illness, right alongside, for example, chemotherapy or dialysis or other treatments intended to treat an underlying condition. Hospice is a type of palliative care where we attend to all those domains of suffering, but it's really in the last 6 months of life that we provide hospice care. And generally at that point, other therapies like chemotherapy have been discontinued. And true end-of-life care is really the last hours to days of life. And I think that is distinct from hospice care and from palliative.
So I guess one question that always seems to pop up is, why don't more people know about palliative care, or why don't more patients or doctors avail themselves of it as a consultative service?
I think that my answer to that is kind of complex and multi-layered a bit, because the phenomenon is complex and multi-layered. So I think there's a lack of familiarity with what palliative care does and doesn't do. The name itself is a bit unpronounceable and vague and makes people feel uneasy. And the association many people, including doctors, have with palliative care is that you provide palliative care when there's, quote unquote, nothing left to do for the patient, which is absolutely not true. But that is the assumption that people have. So I think referrals are not made or sought out because people think that you only call palliative care when you're, quote unquote, giving up on a patient or when you're throwing in the towel. And these are phrases that I've heard families, patients, and doctors use when they talk about palliative care. And really nothing could be further from the truth. The thing that we try to do is really integrate a focus on quality of life and well-being into the patient's life as they are getting any other form of treatment that might be useful for them. So it's very far from giving up or throwing in the towel, but it is maintaining a focus on helping patients live their best life, no matter what's going on for them medically. And since it's a newer field, I think many of my colleagues didn't get adequate exposure to it in their own training. So they're learning as they go, as many of my patients and families are.
Well, that was well put. But one question I think that I want to go over with you, and I think it's a question that your parents very avidly, your mother, who is a physician, asked you, which is, shouldn't all doctors know how to do this?
Yep. Well, that's such a great question. And I was just seeing a patient the other day who has heart failure and whose wife said to me, why didn't my cardiologist talk with us about these topics? And I think that there's a number of reasons that doesn't end up happening. Palliative care was really a response to the lack of focus that highly technical medicine was placing on the disease rather than on the patient and their quality of life. And so we grew as a field out of that lessened focus that medicine in the past has had on the patient as a person, on the family as a unit, as a person as being more than a collection of diseases. One would think that all physicians should be able to do this well, but I will tell you that in my own training in internal medicine, which is adult medicine, I got very little focused training on how to treat cancer pain, for example, on how to treat nausea, on how to understand that different reasons for nausea merited different medications. And I certainly, as I write about in the book, have had very little exposure to, when my training, I had very little exposure to how to sit with a patient and family, tell them that their life was nearing its end, and ask them what they wanted for themselves in that time. So I think we now have evolved specialists to be of assistance to other doctors, and I do think we're a long way off from having a medical system in which all doctors can have this skill set.
Yeah, it's interesting how, I guess, I'm a big believer, in case it's not clear, in palliative care, but I think that it's hard when because you're a new field, you have to sort of fight that existential battle a lot of the time. And I guess I want to ask you one more question in regard to the field itself, and then talk maybe a little bit more about your writing and personal. But early on in the book, you say, I'm just going to read it here, colleagues reacted to our team in equally variable ways. We were both the death squad and angels of mercy, sometimes regarded with suspicion and at other times with admiration. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. So I think, you know, some of my colleagues very much respect what our team does. They understand how difficult our work is, and they admire how we can be with patients and see and be with suffering generally as much as we are. And I think others, kind of going back to what I was saying before, others who are less familiar with what we do regard us as a team that's either there to persuade patients not to get treatment or people who just start morphine drips on patients. And it really involves a lot of constant re-education to colleagues and nursing staff and social workers about the things that we as palliative care doctors do and the things that we don't do. And even those who look at us and say, these are angels of mercy, sometimes they think that because they assume that we facilitate a gentle death, which is also not true, because not all of our work is revolving around death and dying, because palliative care is available to patients at any stage of life with a disease. And so I think both of those extreme looks at us are problematic, even though the one that looks at us as angels of mercy is a little bit more complimentary, but still problematic in its assumption that palliative care is there to facilitate death. We are only there to make the natural process of disease progression as comfortable as possible, not to speed it up.
I want to turn to a formative experience that you write about. This is with a patient that you call Mr. Smith. Now, this was before you were specifically in palliative care, but I think at that point you had been thinking strongly about applying for a fellowship in that field. And if you could, take us through what happened with Mr. Smith. You were, the resident in the ICU, and you were dealing with an intern and a medical student who had a little bit of a different opinion. You had to make a very challenging medical decision about what not to do. And you had the backup of your senior, your attending physician. But this was something that left you with a lot of doubt, but was definitely something that you grew from.
Certainly. So Mr. Smith, I still can never forget his face. He was a gentleman who was a veteran living in a nursing home at the time that I met him. He had widespread incurable cancer of his esophagus and came in with quite a bit of difficulty breathing because, as is common with patients with cancer, he was prone to a blood clot forming and traveling to his lungs. So his breathing was compromised because of that. And as the resident, I was kind of in between being a full autonomous doctor and being a total newbie, as my medical student and intern were. So when I initially evaluated Mr. Smith, he was so thin and he was so disoriented and he couldn't, became very clear that he couldn't talk to me about what he might want for himself and that he wouldn't be able to engage in a discussion about anything I would tell him about his medical condition. And he also had no next of kin and nobody named as a decision maker for him if he couldn't speak. He was a very isolated man. And even the staff at his nursing home had trouble recalling exactly who he was. So when we have no decision maker, sometimes it falls to us as physicians to make some tough decisions about what we should and shouldn't be doing for a patient. And I found myself in that position. My intern and my medical student wanted to give him blood thinners to treat this clot, but really with the hopes that he might wake up and become more oriented and therefore be able to engage in a discussion about his status and what he would want. However, he'd also suffered a major bleed in the last few months before I met him, and so giving him blood thinners was far too risky. And as I looked at this man before me, I had to ask myself, is this problem that he came in with a problem I can fix, or is it the beginning of the dying process? And that is a very hard call to make as someone in your training, but and even for me as someone who was inclined towards palliative care, I still felt like I was making a very consequential decision. And I eventually decided, with the support of my supervising physician, not to treat the blood clot and to focus on treating his breathing to make sure he wasn't short of breath, on treating his disorientation, on making sure that his mouth, because he was mouth breathing a bit, I wanted him not to get dry and cracked lips, and I was going to send him back to the nursing home with hospice services in the morning. And he happened to pass away that night, and I was at his bedside. And I was watching this process of dying unfold in the way that it does, with his heart racing and then slowing down. And I didn't want him to die alone. So when the nurse paged me saying, it looks like he's going, I sat with him for the 3 or 4 hours that it took for him to pass away. And I remember when his breathing stopped and just the way that his whole body relaxed and there was a shift in the room. And what I had to manage the following hours was my intern and my medical student, who had less experience, wondering whether if we'd treated the clot, whether he would be alive. And it really took my supervisor and I trying to help them understand that treating a specific problem may not be in the best interest of the whole person who might suffer terrible consequences from our treatment of one thing, without looking at the overall landscape of his well-being and being able to tell when he was actually in the process of dying. So I'll never forget him, and I'll never forget how much I agonized. And I think navigating things like differences of opinions with colleagues is something that never really goes away. So having a way to deal with it early in your training, I think, is really important.
Yeah, and you were bearing witness to his dying, and when he had nobody else in his life, no family, no next of kin, no proxy. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Sunitha Puri. She is Assistant Professor of Clinical Medicine at University of Southern California, where she also serves as Medical Director of the Palliative Medicine and Supportive Care Service at the Keck Hospital and Norris Cancer Center. She is the author of the new book, That Good Night, Life and Medicine in the 11th Hour, which is a memoir of her life and her training and her decision to go into palliative medicine. And Dr. Puri, I wanted to ask you, you write beautifully about your family in this book. Your parents emigrated to the United States largely because, if I remember correctly, because your mother wanted to pursue medical training. First of all, just in and of itself, she was one of, I think, 7 children. And in a time when not many women went to medical school in India, she managed to surmount that challenge, was able to get a way to fund medical school, and then your parents made their way to, I think, Louisville, Kentucky. Mm-hmm. It was your mom's, both your time with your brother kind of at her knee going to the hospital on many, I guess, weekends when you didn't have school, but also her absence that I think had a very profound impact on you deciding to go into medicine. Tell us a little bit about your mom.
So my mother and my father, I consider them to be the heartbeat of this book because both of them are scientists. My mom's an anesthesiologist and my dad's an engineer, and both of them are very deeply spiritual people. They both grew up in pretty terrible poverty in post-independence India, which had gone through its own upheavals. And they somehow, through their belief in the divine and their strong faith, were able to make it out of that poverty. And my mother was someone that I am very attached to. And I would go with her, as you mentioned, to the hospital and enter this interesting world with her where surgeons and other anesthesiologists were kind of part of her extended family. And I would go with her sometimes to the recovery room to see patients after she had taken them out of the operating room, and she'd be checking in on them hours later. She's always very good about that. And I would see how much her patients liked her and how compassionate she was, not just with them, but with my brother and I. And so I knew that medicine was a fundamental part of the fabric of my mother. And yet, as you also mentioned, it kept her from me. She'd be on overnight calls that would be brutal. I would come home from school just wanting to spend time with her, but she needed to sleep. And so I resented and loved medicine. I resented it because it kept her from me, and I loved it because I know she loves it. And I loved the person that she was in the hospital, this feisty little woman who was not afraid to go to battle with surgeons if she thought there was no reason for a very sick, frail patient to get a big surgery. And she was the same one who would ask patients before they went to the operating room if they have a system of faith and whether praying with her would be something they'd want to do. And so I really was introduced to medicine through this incredible human being who wasn't afraid to be both a scientist and a spiritualist. And I have no doubt that that example kind of led me to palliative care, where I am asked to be someone with my patients who can talk about the medical, but also all of the things we cannot see, and the ideas of faith and spirituality.
Yeah, and you write beautifully about, I think, your inner conflict about your parents' religiosity. So in one part of the book, your father is diagnosed with a blockage of one of his coronary arteries.
Mm-hmm.
And as you pointed out, he's an engineer, and your mother's a physician, and they go, you are at a hospital or a cardiologist place, wherever that is, and your mother actually asks to put a picture of, is it Ganesh, on your father's chest?
Mm-hmm.
And I was just kind of stunned because, of course, I'm thinking, wow, he's going into some operating suite, but of course, it's a catheter, so it's going through the artery in his leg. They're not actually going to cut open his chest. And I couldn't even imagine. I mean, I've never seen a patient do that. And and so the level of their profound faith was really striking. And then you ask them many times, or I guess in your own mind, wonder, you know, how is it that these scientists could have such enormous faith in what amounts to religion or the supernatural? And so how, I guess, you know, and it probably you still are reconciling it to a large extent, but I mean, how do you formulate your own approach to spirituality?
So I think, you know, the term spirituality, I think of as so different from having a faith system. I think of spirituality as having a reverence for the divine, however someone might define that, and at least an inclination to believe that there's something more than what we can see physically at work. And I think for me, of all things, becoming a doctor has made me more spiritual. And I'll give you an example. When I was in my residency, I was covering the hospital overnight, the cardiology service. I was completely petrified, as most second-year residents are when they're covering a whole hospital full of very sick people alone. I admitted two men to the hospital within maybe 20 or 30 minutes of each other. Both were of the same ethnic background. Both had high blood pressure, high cholesterol, were overweight, and had diabetes. Both were the same age. And both had huge heart attacks coming from the blockage of the left-sided artery. They were basically medically identical. I did the same things for both patients. And one of them died that night, and the other one was discharged from the hospital in a week. And I remember sitting and thinking, I did the right things for all of them. I used science that is evidence-based, that has been validated, that has worked for a lot of patients. So why did one of them die and the other one live? And I think that's when I started to go back to a lot of the teachings of my parents about the limits of medicine, the potential for something beyond us to seal our fate. And it was really starting to understand that nature and the body have limits that may not be scientifically totally clear or understood, but that in a spiritual sense might make sense. So when I would hear, you know, a supervising attending who I wrote about in the book talk about the stopping of the heart or death as God's call, that kind of summarized to me the very different ways that even one medical event like death could be seen medically as the loss of a heartbeat and spiritually as the call, as a return home in a way. And so I really, of all things, I really think it took me becoming a scientist, a medical doctor, to start to inquire within myself about why things would turn out for my patients the way they did. And I have to say that having a spiritual sense of things brings me comfort as a doctor.
And Dr. Puri, I wanted to go back to your parents. Initially, they were not too enthusiastic about your choice to pursue advanced training in palliative care. It didn't go so well, but I think, suffice it to say, they've come around. But what was that like for you when they weren't initially supportive?
Well, I was really taken aback because there's so much in my field of the very things that they taught me. And so I thought they would be proud. But instead, both of them were like, well, don't all doctors kind of help people suffer less? Like, what do you mean you're going to focus on quality of life and suffering? And my mom, you know, she knows that I am, especially as a writer and an artist, a very sensitive soul. So she worried that me being around death all the time was going to break me. So I think their fears were well-intentioned, but they still took me with quite a bit of surprise. And then I went back into my residency after I'd gone home to talk to them for that weekend, and I really tried hard to throw myself into my intensive care unit rotation to try to be like my mother. And yet, forcing myself to try and embody her didn't work. And I had to kind of reconcile that my mother may have been my inspiration to this career, but now I have to forge my own path. And at some point, I just had to trust that my parents would understand and support me. And I think the most powerful scene, at least for me in writing the book, was the scene where my mother finally says to me, I could never do what you do.
I'm wondering if you've mentioned that your art and your writing, and clearly this is your first book, but you have also written in a number of different, you've written for medical journals like the Journal of the American Medical Association, but your bio also says you've written for the New York Times and Slate. Tell us a little bit about your writing, I guess, what inspires you and how you approach your art.
So, you know, I had always, well before I came to medical school, I had always been a writer at heart. I would write these short stories and poems and essays, and I kept extensive journals. And for me, writing was a place to work out on the page either something I was observing or a fictional world that I wanted to create for a certain reason. So it was always my first tool. Words were always my first tool. I used to tell myself stories when my parents were busy and I needed to keep myself company. And so stories were always very near and dear to my heart. As a writer, I think it's always very interesting to be both a physician and a writer because I'm kind of always looking in my writerly way to understand human beings. And in my job as a palliative care doctor, what I am doing is trying to understand human beings under extreme stress. But under extreme stress, you still see the glimmers of who people used to be and who they still are and who they want to be. And so you get to really artistically mine this rich territory of love, loss, grief, anger, joy even. And so I use a lot of what I see at work to have a specific lens on my writing and my artistry that I think has made it richer. But even like I think for my next book, I'm probably going to write something that is not situated in medicine or in the hospital specifically. But you still have available to you that insider's look on human nature in times of great stress and when people are facing the one experience that all of us will face. And it really, the nuance that I've learned to use in my language and conversations with patients, and learning how to listen really deeply to them, I think has made me a better writer.
Are there other media that you work in when you talk about art? I mean, painting or other things, or poetry particularly?
Oh, no. I mostly am a writer. I play several instruments, so that's kind of, I think, actually been an interesting adjunct to my writing, because if you think about the idea of lyricism in writing and a certain flow, for me, I've found that playing the piano and playing the harmonium, which is an Indian instrument, you're thinking about lyricism and flow in a certain way there. And I think that has actually helped with some of what I always strive for, which is a certain musicality of the writing and the pacing of something that I'm working on.
Now, one of your other professional roles is that you serve as chair of the ethics committee, I believe, at Keck Hospital at USC. For our listeners, tell what that involves. What is involved in being the chair of an ethics committee at a big teaching hospital like that?
So an ethics committee, it serves a very particular purpose, which is to help anyone in the hospital, so not just physicians and nurses, but even families and patients and staff who have a concern that a particular thing happening in their care may or may not be ethically correct. And as opposed to, for example, a call for a palliative care consult, which at least at USC only a doctor can call, anybody who's worried that, for example, the patient and family may be wanting treatment that is unreasonable, or, you know, the families and patient might think they're not getting enough treatment, anyone can call the ethics committee, which is made up of physicians, nurses, hospital staff, and even a community member who's not affiliated with our hospital and chaplaincy and social work, and they can call and request a review of a particular situation. And what's nice about an ethics committee is you have a relatively unbiased group of people who go over the facts of the case. A subcommittee will go and meet everybody involved in the case and try to come up with a precise articulation of what is the ethical challenge here and recommendations on how we might go about addressing it. And I like ethics committees so much because they kind of make sure that the right things are happening for people, and that when something feels uncomfortable, there's a neutral body to go to explore the issues that someone may not feel empowered to raise themselves. So, you know, I've had, for example, residents call an ethics consult and ask me to keep their name anonymous, which I can absolutely do. I can't do that when someone calls me for a palliative care consult. I have to put in my note, Dr. So-and-so requested it for this reason. But I think the anonymity and the variety of perspectives on an ethical problem that a committee can bring it's a really rich addition to a hospital environment.
Well, it's a beautifully written memoir, and the name of it is That Good Night, Life and Medicine in the 11th Hour. And it's by my guest today, Dr. Sunita Puri, who is an assistant professor of clinical medicine at University of Southern California, where she's also medical director of the Palliative Medicine and Supportive Care Service at the Keck Hospital and Norris Cancer Center at USC. Dr. Sunita Puri, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.